The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you don't buy into this idea that our country was founded upon Christian principles. In fact, many of these so-called founding fathers who called themselves Christians or at least spoke favorably about Christianity owned slaves. They had slavery as an institution. Yes, certainly, this peculiar feature of American history has been part of our national dialogue for quite some time, but especially in the past few weeks. What began as a seemingly ordinary interview on ABC's Good Morning America has spawned a national discussion that could properly be called Wake Up America. The time has come for a more balanced and productive dialogue on the subject of slavery and its relationship to our founding fathers. Symbolic incarnations of the debate were represented by television journalist George Stephanopoulos and the congresswoman he sharply challenged, GOP presidential hopeful Michelle Bachmann.
For example, earlier this year, you said that the founding fathers who wrote the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence worked tirelessly to end slavery. Now, with respect, Congresswoman, that's just not true. Many of them, including Jefferson and Washington, were actually slaveholders, and slavery didn't end until the Civil War.
You know, what's marvelous is that in this country and under our Constitution, we have the ability, when we recognize that something is wrong, to change it. And that's what we did in our country. We changed it. We no longer have slavery. That's a good thing. And what our Constitution has done for our nation is to give us the basis of freedom unparalleled in the rest of the world. That's what people want to get back.
I agree with that,
Congressman. Because they realize that our government is taking away their freedom.
But that's not what you said. You said that the founding fathers worked tirelessly to end slavery.
Well, if you look at one of our founding fathers, John Quincy Adams, that's absolutely true. He was a very young boy when he was with his father, serving essentially as his father's secretary. He tirelessly worked throughout his life to make sure that we did, in fact, one day eradicate slavery from our nation.
He wasn't one of the founding fathers.
And I'm so grateful for that work.
He was a president. He was a secretary of state. As a member of Congress, you're right. He did work to end slavery decades later. But so you're standing by this comment that the founding fathers worked tirelessly to end slavery?
Well, John Quincy Adams most certainly was a part of the Revolutionary War era. He was a young boy, but he was actively involved.
Instead of arguing over what age a person must reach before posterity transforms him from a youthful assistant to a founding father, our time might be better served to agree that, frankly, Bachmann could have chosen better examples had she done so. Had she chosen better examples, George's gotcha moment would have backfired, creating far more discussions about a Stephanopoulos gaffe. Now, in fairness to the ABC host, he may have merely intended to convey that neither the final drafts of the Declaration of Independence nor the Constitution provided for emancipation. All right, true enough. Fair enough, but the life deeds of our founding fathers do not live in those documents alone. Researching their personal history should be an objective process. All too often, our emotions get in the way. The very word slavery at once produces images of shame and images of pride. We can be proud of the many Americans who either dedicated their lives or sacrificed their lives to eventually end this horrific institution. And of course, we also shudder to think that a wicked, inexcusable mistreatment of people could ever have been embraced by our country at all. American history is a paradox and can only be viewed honestly as a dual truth. On one hand, the word hypocrisy seems almost too obvious a description for our nation forged upon premises of freedom, all the while embracing the most opposite idea to freedom ever witnessed. In the mind of any decent thinker, nothing could be more abhorrent than human beings actually buying, selling, and owning other human beings. On the other hand, much as idealistic individuals hate to admit it, life can often be a series of contradictions and ethical dilemmas. 21st century citizens, with their 2020 hindsight, find 18th century moral paradoxes difficult to fathom. As a result, they dive into conversations of conscience with simplistic thinking. But folks, the legacy left behind by our founding fathers is simplistic only in its ideals. The accomplishment of these ideals came into being like a long three-act play, one where the protagonist had to deal with a few demons of his own, unable to quickly slay dragons with his shining armor. American history is both wonderful and horrible at the same time. People often embrace the record they were exposed to first, forgetting to play its flip side. We have the luxury of living at a time when verbal condemnation of slavery was one of the first lessons taught by grade school teachers. Earlier generations were offered a strikingly different presentation of this peculiar institution. That any people at all in those days rose above such brainwashing to fight the practice is to be admired, even if they moved more slowly than molasses. Men like John Adams were quite vocal against slavery and said with passion, "Never in my life did I own a slave." Between the years 1777 to 1804, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, and New Jersey either abolished slavery or passed laws setting into motion its eventual demise. These decisions were not made in a vacuum and were partially influenced by our founding fathers. The new states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin joined the Union slave-free as a result of standards put in place earlier for the Northwest Territory during the Ordinance of 1787, inspired by Rufus King, one of the Constitution's signers. Founding fathers involved with societies for ending slavery included Richard Bassett, James Madison, James Monroe, John Marshall, and many more. Nevertheless, skeptics love to remind us of founders who spoke against slavery, yet owned slaves themselves, some their entire lives. Indeed, the much-admired Ben Franklin owned servants, but changed his views on slavery as he grew older and helped to establish the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. Thomas Jefferson tried unsuccessfully through the Continental Congress to pass a law ending slavery and also penned some famous words, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free." Unfortunately, Jefferson found himself unable to personally break from the practice, in part because of its financial trappings. Personal writings reveal that the man was tortured. Absolutely tortured and tormented over his own inconsistencies. I'm reading from a letter that he wrote Miss Frances Wright on August 7th, 1825. Thomas Jefferson speaking. "At the age of 82, with one foot in the grave and the other uplifted to follow it, I do not permit myself to take part in any new enterprises, even for bettering the condition of man, not even in the great one which is the subject of your letter and which has been through life that of my greatest anxieties." And similarly conflicted, George Washington remained a slave owner his entire life, but also worked against the importing of new slaves into American colonies and eventually vowed to never personally again buy or sell a slave. Finally, Washington arranged for the release of all personal slaves at the time of his death and of his wife's death. Such self-reflection and growth can't be overestimated. Our human conscience tends to hide on the mind's back shelf when bombarded by popular, accepted practices of society. Now, a typical ancient Roman, if you went up to him and asked him how he felt about murder, would have condemned it without hesitation. Murder? Cold-blooded murder? Of course. course, it's wrong. But you ask that same guy how he feels about the Gladiator Games, that very same citizen may have offered a completely different answer and a puzzled expression, since in his mind, the Gladiator fights were mere sporting events. It was like going to the Super Bowl. Now, America today, having long since settled its position on slavery, remains sharply divided over other matters of conscience. The jury is still out on how future generations will look back at us. While we look back at others, other people will look back at us. Make no mistake, one such issue, the red hot topic of abortion. Yeah, that serves as an interesting analogy. Now, you may currently ascribe to a pro-choice position. If so, I respect your view, okay? I respect your view. I'm not pro-choice myself, but if you're pro-choice, I respect that. But let me carefully explain what I mean when I say I respect it. I respect your view provided you sincerely, deep in your heart, believe the unborn fetus is something less than a life. Now, science has actually proven that it is a life. Even the word fetus is the Latin word for baby or little one. But still, let's just assume for the moment that you're sincere in your belief. Let's look at other people sincere in their beliefs who change their beliefs. Because meanwhile, many, many who once defended a woman's right to abortion are now leading activists in pro-life organizations, having personally concluded that the unborn child, even at an early state, is in fact a living human being, not mere tissue or property, if you will, property of another human being to be kept or disposed of at will simply because it resides inside the mother's body. As a matter of fact, countless testimonies of key women who take on such causes reveal how they once had abortions themselves. Does such personal history make them hypocrites? Or instead, people who rethought a moral situation based upon their own experience with the situation? Our joint pilgrimage as human beings includes the marvelous ability to learn, grow, and eventually change. This is also true for countries. For countries. Slowly but surely, the high ideals of our founding fathers have been put into more consistent operation. If some historians made the mistake of painting these men as saints, just as many are mistaken to paint them as devils. They were, in fact, human beings. Nothing more, nothing less.
There is a way that leads to life. That find it never die. Past mountain peaks, graced white with snow, the way grows brighter as it goes. There is a road inside of you, inside of me.
No stumbling pilgrim in the dark.
joy is not in where we've been. Joy is who's waiting at the end. There is a road inside of you, inside of me. There is one true. No stumbling pilgrim in the dark. The road to Zion's in your heart. No stumbling pilgrim in the dark. The road to Zion's in your heart. The road to Zion's in your heart. The road to Zion's in your heart.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Very political time in our history, isn't it? George Orwell predicted a time would come when we would change our words to soften the truth and impact of our actions. His chilling prophecy has been fulfilled, but the numbing effect is not limited to words alone. It also applies to phrases. Now, allow me to introduce a whole new kind of lexicon, a sort of lexicon, newspeak-style, politically correct titles, expressions, and designations. Step right up, test yourself, and see how quickly you decipher the coded messages behind our nation's touchy-feely pop rhetoric. In the interest of being as inclusive as possible, allow me to start light with some familiar examples that all of us, liberal or conservative, can relate to and agree upon. After that, I fear my conservative peers will enjoy the exercise a little more than the liberals, but I want my liberal friends to listen too, because I like you. Honestly, I do. We'll begin with familiar words from a simple restaurant. We've all been to restaurants, so we start with some commonality. A hostess, you know, the woman that, she's not the waitress, but she takes your name. She speaks to you right after you walk through the front door, right after you approach her, you get her attention, and she says, "I'll be right with you. I'll be right with you." Yeah, I'll be right with you. Translation. Actually, I have no idea when I will be with you, except that I know it's going to take a good long time. After all, if I were really going to be right with you, I wouldn't have needed to say anything, but since I just acknowledged your presence, you're going to be cool about it, aren't you? Now, later on, you're seated. You have an actual waitress or waiter. You give your order, and oh gosh, 30, 40, 45, 50 minutes goes by. You finally summon your waitress and ask her to check on your order to find out what happened. She hurries into the kitchen with a frantic look on her face. She comes back and says, "It's coming right up." Yeah. Yeah, it's coming right up. Translation. If you hadn't signaled us, we would never have even remembered anything about this order. Since you did bring it up, we quickly threw it on the grill. Had you not inquired, your order would have been as lost as King Solomon's mines. Okay, now, that wasn't too painful, was it? Getting the point? People do not always speak what they actually mean. Let's study one more easy example before bringing on the big guns. You're at a movie theater, big cinema complex, the AMC 20 or Miramar 18, one of those. Recorded voice at the movie theater long before the featured presentation says, "Welcome to the pre-show entertainment." Yeah, welcome to the pre-show entertainment. Translation, welcome to 20 minutes of commercials, These commercials build revenue for our theaters because the $11 you just shelled out for your ticket and the $17 you spent on a box of Milk Duds is not enough. All right. Time to leave the world of food and films for a PC explanation of current events, current entities, and current opinions. First phrase on the PC lexicon, Fox News. In the world of the PC, Fox News is defined as a mockery of real journalism because their opinion programs tilt to the right. Which leads to the next on our list, the mainstream media. A politically correct definition of mainstream media, the objective, unbiased news, which never, ever editorializes from the left, but instead shares those common sense ideas that any thinking, sophisticated person ought to have. And the politically correct definition of racist. You know what a racist is? Well, these days, and definitions do change these days, anyone who objects to Obama's ideas of wealth redistribution or anyone who objects to Obama's foreign policy, in brief, anyone who objects to anything Obama says or does, period, that person is a racist. Even those who voted for him the first time, if they don't vote for him the second time, they won't do it because they're racist. Pro-choice. We've all heard that term. We talked about it a little bit during our opening monologue. Pro-choice, a term for accepting the rights of mothers to have an abortion. How about this one? Pro-responsibility. Well, that's a term for allowing the government to deny all other choices, such as what we eat, drink, smoke, drive, listen to on the radio, or choose to teach our children by homeschooling them. Next, in the PC lexicon, the definition of the phrase responsible national security. Responsible national security is an airport security check forcing an old lady to remove her diaper. That's responsible national security. Well, what about irresponsible, paranoid, compassionless national security? That's insisting that those who vote in elections show identification, such as a driver's license. What is the politically correct definition for national language? Something any country other than America should be allowed to have. And the politically correct definition for borders? Something else which any country other than America should be allowed to have. The politically correct definition of tolerant is a description for anyone willing to maintain a positive view of those with same-sex lifestyles. But the politically correct definition of hateful, that's a description of anyone with the unmitigated nerve to tolerate an opposing view regarding same-sex lifestyles. We'll continue with the politically correct lexicon. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric. I'm going through the politically correct lexicon for not just words, but phrases. Here's the politically correct definition for responsible sacrificial compromise for Republican politicians. The responsible thing for Republicans to do is forsake their conservative principles and do things exactly as Democrats want them done. However, the responsible sacrifice and compromise for Democratic politicians is maintaining their liberal principles, because to do otherwise would be to forsake the poor and disenfranchised. So, you know, if we're going to have unity, the Republicans just need to do things the way the Democrats want them done. Speaking of that, and a lot of this has been going on as they're talking about raising the debt ceiling, the definition of Medicare and Social Security, that is the politically correct definition of Medicare and Social Security, important services which President Obama insists will be cut if he isn't allowed to have our debt ceiling raised along with increased taxes. Well, related to that then, what about the stimulus package? Because Obama had something to do with that too. There have been several of them, but I'll give you an example of one. The $787 billion in fiscally responsible funds from Obama and his 2009 Congress, which was used for other important services, such as $6 million for a snow-making facility in Duluth, Minnesota. Now, please don't be disagreeable and partisan by reminding us that it already snows about 6 months out of the year in that state. How about the $1.5 million for a fence to keep people from jumping off the All-American Bridge in Akron, Ohio? Yeah, since individuals don't already know that they shouldn't leap from bridges, such money demonstrates our government's compassion and sense of responsibility toward protecting the lives of its citizens. Or $2.5 million in stimulus checks sent to people who have already died. $2.5 million in stimulus checks sent to people who have already passed away. Now that has to be the greatest all-time example of money well spent. Continuing with our politically correct lexicon, a straight face. You know what the definition is of a straight face? That's a look maintained by President Obama in the midst of discussions aimed at fixing our national debt, where he claims that Republicans, unlike himself, are in election mode right now and not truly interested in problem solving. Or the politically correct definition of the phrase, you're a fascist. You're a fascist. Those are words spoken by a liberal instead of, I do not know how to counter the points you just made with any honest reflection or reasoning. Now, what you've been listening to, of course, is satire. Obviously, there are exceptions. I've met many reasonable liberals. I've met dumb conservatives. There's always exceptions. This was satire, but that leads to our next one. That needs to the next definition of the lexicon, because a lot of liberals usually hate it when conservative talk radio uses satire. But we don't usually hear them complain about the satire of, say, Saturday Night Live or The Daily Show or the monologues of Bill Maher. So two more definitions. Satire from a liberal poking fun at conservatives. Well, that's something harmless, clever, brilliant, and insightful. But satire from a conservative poking fun at liberals, something mean-spirited and hateful. This is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious. And I'd like to hear what you have to say as well. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, our call-in toll-free number, 888-344-1170. You can reach us also through Facebook, through Twitter, or directly by email, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. Now, last week, I spent a lot of time on the program with the controversial question, was Jesus gay? And I started with, well, Elton John and a Catholic psychiatrist. They were different people, and I mentioned all over the internet there are people claiming that Jesus might have had a same-sex relationship with John. So in both an article I wrote for Washington Times Communities and a monologue I did here on the radio, I talked about Jesus and what his true beliefs were. One of the objections to the conservative view on this is that Jesus never mentioned homosexuality. And I mentioned on the air and in my article, but this is from Grace. Grace is quoting from the Washington Times piece. She quotes me quoting Jesus. So she sends the quote back, Matthew chapter 5, where my idea here, my thought was that Jesus did refer to the entire Old Testament law, that we must still keep it. And that included commandments against homosexuality. So it was kind of an inductive process here. So she quotes me quoting Jesus. Jesus said, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven." Now, then I gave an example of one of these laws that Jesus is referring to. It's found in Leviticus chapter 18. Do not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. That is detestable. So Grace is taking issue with this quote, and she says this: "So that means Jesus is also authenticating the abominations of eating shellfish and wearing mixed cloth? You can cherry pick, Mr. Siegel. If your God says something, is it not true? If man gets to pick which of God's statements are true, what does that say about God's power? As Mark Twain so eloquently stated, you know your God is man-made when he hates all the same people you do." So she's implying that God is man-made. I actually have a great respect for Mark Twain. Mark Twain did not believe in the God of the Bible, but he did believe in God. So atheists are a little bit disingenuous when they quote Mark Twain. But let me respond directly to what Grace said. Grace, the old covenant was in operation before Jesus went to the cross. We may read about Jesus in a book that we call the New Testament, but testament means covenant or agreement. There's the old agreement between God and people. There's the new agreement between God and people. The old agreement was in operation. So when Jesus quoted the law, and he said it stays in operation until everything is accomplished. Well, when was everything accomplished? When he went to the cross, his last words were, "It is finished." Everything was then accomplished. Prior to that, yes, he expected people to follow the entire Old Testament law, and that included the shellfish, and that included not mixing wool and linen together. It included all that stuff. However, the new covenant came into operation afterwards, and under the new covenant, those ritualistic laws, the moral laws, remain in operation. The ritualistic ones, such as foods, do not. You can read about that in Acts chapter 10, where Peter receives a vision, where God tells him that his dietary commands have changed. This is not picking and choosing, Grace. This is simply reading what the Bible actually says without imposing an agenda upon it. I love shellfish myself. I'm very glad I was born under this covenant. I love bacon, too. I wouldn't have done well under the old covenant. But God in his infinite wisdom put me under the new covenant. Now, Grace, I did go on in that article and I showed that under the new covenant, Paul, with the authority granted to him by Jesus and his apostles, also condemned homosexuality. So there is a statement about homosexuality, several, but I read a key one in the New Testament. Paul wasn't condemning the sinner, but was condemning the sin. I made that very clear in the article too. You conveniently ignored that part of my article, Grace. So now who's cherry picking? Now who's picking and choosing? Oh, Grace, one more thing. In that article that you read, I was very kind to those with a gay lifestyle. In fact, one of the readers who disagreed with me thanked me for being so kind. I was kind, frankly, far more kind and far less judgmental than your vicious accusation, which calls me a hater simply because I happen to disagree with a person's lifestyle. Human beings disagree with each other all the time, Grace. That certainly includes you, because by admitting that you don't believe in God and suggesting that he's man-made, are you not expressing a disagreement with my faith? Are you not expressing a disagreement with my lifestyle? Grace, does that make you full of hate? Grace, maybe you should examine your own lack of tolerance. I know that atheists consider themselves to be logical thinkers, Grace, and I was an atheist myself for many years. I'm going to give you a very logical way to think this through when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own website simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. To our program, I've been reading a letter from Grace. On last week's program and in a Washington Times Communities article, I defended the idea that Jesus Christ actually was not gay, that he did not carry on a homosexual lifestyle with John. I did it by looking at the Greek, by looking at the different words they used for love. John was called the apostle whom Jesus loved. But among other things, Grace said that I was full of hate and that I simply made up a God who agreed with my hate. And before we went to the break, I challenged Grace, and I said, well, Grace, since you don't believe in God, you obviously disagree with my lifestyle, because God is my life. So, Grace, I know atheists consider themselves to be very rational people, and I respect that. I was an atheist myself for many years before I became a Christian, Grace. You're not listening to somebody who grew up in the church. This is somebody who found evidence for Christianity and an experience with the Spirit of God and became a Christian, not because of blind faith, but because of facts. I know that sounds bizarre to you. That's fine. You can believe what you want. But Grace, if you are full of hate yourself, then you shouldn't be lecturing others about hate. And you're defining hate, evidently, as somebody who disagrees with somebody's lifestyles. You disagree with mine. So let me say this again, Grace, very carefully. If you yourself are full of hate, then you shouldn't be lecturing others about hate. On the other hand, Grace, if you don't hate all Christians simply because you disagree with them, and I suspect that you probably don't hate all Christians, Grace. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I don't think you hate all Christians. And if you don't hate all Christians simply because you disagree with them, then why should you suggest that Christians hate those who they disagree with, such as those promoting a gay lifestyle? Just something to think about, Grace. Please feel free to write again. Now, Robert, also commenting on last week's program, agreed with what I said regarding same-sex marriage. He says they can call it anything they like, but we all know that scripturally it isn't marriage. If it makes them feel better to call an aberrant behavior by a name to make it appear more legitimate, okay. They can't even be honest enough to tell us why they insist on marriage and not a civil union. Regarding my politically correct lexicon that we went through, Jim writes, love it. Ursus says, PC is not pop rhetoric. That's what I called it, pop rhetoric. He says, PC is not pop rhetoric. It is a communist construct specifically designed to stifle free speech. Well, Ursus, I see what you're saying. I agree that in some corners, devious people do steer such an agenda. Unfortunately, many innocent but misled people go along with PC movements, which informally pop up in many places. But yes, the end result is the same. We are on a road to less and less free speech. Now, all of you know this next person, Gabriella Hoffman. She's been no stranger to my show. She's been on a lot. Frequent guest. She also writes for Washington Times Communities. And she wrote to me, political correctness is cultural Marxism. This variant and its other forms are antithetical to human nature. Thank you for putting it in layman's terms for people, Bob. I think they will enjoy reading this article. Well, thank you, Gabriella. Now, she also commented... Gabrielle also commented about what I had to say about Michelle Bachmann and the Founding Fathers and slavery. She says, great article, Bob. I always enjoy your insight. Unfortunately, the mainstream media will go after Bachmann's statements. Nevertheless, she will clarify her errors and do it with poise. She isn't entirely wrong on this statement. As humans, we can certainly use better words or examples. Nevertheless, thanks for the commentary. On the same subject, Anne on Facebook says, nicely done. Bachmann and Perry, who hasn't entered yet, are my favorite Republican contenders. I hope Bachmann does develop better filters. Any T not crossed or I undotted will raise the ire of those on the left, and they hold the vast majority of media outlets with the exception of talk radio. Yeah, hear, hear, talk radio. Now, George on Facebook says, regarding the article version of this, reposting this so my friends can have a read. Well, thank you for doing that, George. He says, this one had me thinking about the Founding Fathers in a way that I had not in the past. Fresh perspective on an age-old movement. Lest we forget, these men forged an alliance of very different views around a central theme, freedom and self-governance. As varied as the actors were, they shared a vision for a future, pledged their lives and fortunes to that vision, and united against the only system they had known. Alone and up against the most powerful nation on the planet at the time, they pulled off the unbelievable. Well, that's very well stated, George, and thank you for your kind comments about my article. Oh, by the way, do you know who else made sure others saw that article? Another George. A different George. George Stephanopoulos. He tweeted it. He tweeted the thing. I don't know if he tweeted it because he liked it, or tweeted it because he hated it, or tweeted it merely because his name was on it, but he tweeted, and now that goes on my resume. I have been tweeted by ABC News host George Stephanopoulos. Well, I can die now. I can die now. Patty on Facebook says the mainstream media will be relentless in portraying legitimate conservative candidates as ignorant louts in the 2012 campaign. Despite her considerable qualifications, Michelle Bachmann is now under attack. Here's some truth. This is what she's saying about my article. Here's some truth for those who are willing to read a little history and be informed rather than listen to quick sound bites from liberal media twits with an agenda. It's always interesting to hear one woman call another woman a twit. That's sometimes a derogatory thing that men say. This is a woman who said it, and I just quoted her, okay? I just quoted her. Spectre says, you know, people use a lot of different names when they're writing over the internet. Spectre says, thanks for the expanded treatment, but please, do you really think that had Ms. Bachmann chosen her words more carefully, there would have been extended discussions of a George Stephanopoulos gaffe? Perhaps in the pages of the Washington Times, but nowhere else. Well, you may have a point, my friend. Perhaps such a discussion should have happened in such a case, but the mainstream media might have buried it. You're absolutely right about that. Specter continues. He says, I think we will find with Michelle, as happened with Sarah, that there will be no limits on what can be said about her, no distortion too great, and those who attack her from the left will never be called to account either by their audience or by their employers. All that said, if Representative Bachmann really wants to make a serious run at the presidency, she's going to have to develop better filters. Her gaffes don't really bother me. I don't think for a nanosecond that she actually confused John Wayne with John Wayne Gacy, but there's no good reason to give the snipers any ammunition. And again, thank you for the article and especially the quotes at the end. Excellent research. Well, thank you for the encouragement, Spectre. Now, Catpo didn't care too much for the article. He says, to read what really happened. See, I didn't tell you what really happened. Catpo says, to read what really happened regarding slavery and where our founding fathers stood, go to Joseph Ellis's acclaimed Founding Brothers, the Revolutionary Generation, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and read Chapter 3. It will clarify once and for all what really happened as he cites documents and actual letters, speeches, etc. from that time. No matter how you slice it or apologize for her, Bachmann had it wrong. Okay, that was from Catpo. Catpo, not exactly a thoughtful, logical, point-by-point refutation of my article and its own quotes, documentations, etc. Instead, you merely refer us to a book. Great response, Catpo. Please rate again. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Back to our program. At the top of the show, I did a monologue regarding this whole thing of slavery and the founding fathers and how a lot of them did work against it, but they had to compromise with the southern colonies and they did the best they could in their lifetimes. And of course, there was a version of that on the Washington Times Communities over the internet, which publishes my articles in a column called Forbidden Table Talk. So you can always find, not always, but frequently find literary or online literary versions of my monologues. And here's from Izzy responding to that, basically saying that it was a waste of time for me to write the article. She says, who cares? Slavery was a practice in biblical times. Will you throw out the Bible? There is still slave practices in some Muslim countries, not counting their treatment of women and their contracts. In the United States, there are a lot more pressing issues that should be discussed that can be dealt with rather than listen to a banter exercise. Well, Izzy, thank you for writing, but I must say, having a correct understanding of our heritage and knowing that many of our founding fathers did work against slavery is more than a banter exercise. By the way, Izzy, although slavery went on in ancient Rome, the Apostle Paul in the Bible condemned slavery in three places, 1 Corinthians 7, 1 Timothy chapter 1, and Galatians chapter 3. On the other hand, Izzy, you are correct when you say the practice still goes on in some Muslim countries, used to go on in many of them, still goes on in some. And I do agree that many of the people who like to dwell on America once embracing slavery over 100 years ago do not find it politically correct to challenge the Muslim countries which embrace slavery now. That is an irony, Izzy. Thank you for pointing that out. Now, this is Joan responding to the fact that I mentioned George Stephanopoulos had a gaffe of his own when he said that our founding fathers did not work against slavery. She says, whose gaffe? Founding father, close but no cigar. Google birth date of John Quincy Adams and the date of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. Pretty good trick to be a founding father at that age. Well, Joan, in both of my articles that I wrote about Michelle Bachmann these last 2 weeks for Washington Times Communities, and both of my monologues that I shared about her on the radio show these past 2 weeks, I agreed that John Quincy Adams was not a good example. I couldn't have said it any more clearly. But Joan, I also gave many other examples you failed to comment on. If Stephanopoulos thinks no founding fathers worked against slavery, then it is indeed his gaffe. Now, Marcus, talking about something similar, says, Michelle Bachmann said, and he quotes her, but we also know that the very founders who wrote those documents worked tirelessly until slavery was no more in the United States. This just isn't true. It's obvious that it isn't true. Why are you still writing about it? Well, first of all, Marcus, it's not your place to be challenging why I write about things. I'll write whatever I want, just as you continue to write your comments to my articles. And Marcus, Michelle Bachmann didn't say the documents themselves ended slavery. I gave examples of some of the men working on those documents who also worked to end slavery. And Marcus, that's why I'm still writing about this. Marcus then continues, and notice that when he continues, he makes my point anyway by acknowledging that some of the fathers did work against slavery, but he makes it by trying to defend Stephanopoulos and saying that Stephanopoulos acknowledged that. And he says, Stephanopoulos didn't say that he thought no founding fathers worked against slavery. He was merely pointing out that Bachmann's quote, but we also know the very founders that wrote those documents worked tirelessly until slavery was no more in the United States, was incorrect. He was correct in that. The example of a founding father she used, John Quincy Adams, was also incorrect since he was not a founding father. I'm having trouble understanding why you're trying to defend a person who was clearly in the wrong and refused to even admit it. Okay, actually, Marcus, Stephanopoulos did say that. Now, maybe that's not what he meant, but that's what he said. I said in both my articles about Bachman and John Quincy Adams, I'll say it again, John Quincy Adams was not a good example. I gave better examples. Now, you say you're having trouble understanding why I'm writing this article. Well, what you are having trouble with, my friend, is actually reading and or comprehending my article. The article was not about Bachman. It is about the issue sparked by her comments. I also gave Stephanopoulos the benefit of the doubt. But then you probably glossed over that too. His statement on its face was wrong. He said, and I'm quoting him exactly, he said to Michelle Bachman, earlier this year, you said that the founding fathers who wrote the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence worked tirelessly to end slavery. Now, with respect, Congresswoman, that's just not true. Okay, but it was true. Still, I mercifully suggested that he might have meant something different. I said, and now I'm quoting from my article, I said, in fairness to the ABC host, he may have merely intended to convey that neither the final drafts of the Declaration of Independence nor the Constitution provided for emancipation. True enough, but the life deeds of our founding fathers do not live in those documents alone. So his statement on its face was wrong. I still gave him the benefit of the doubt. I can't do much better than that for you, my friend. This next one is from a fellow who calls himself Finnish Strong. He says, hating the founding fathers for owning slaves is a very hard thing indeed. It is analogous to hating one's parents for having said, do as I say, not as I do. The common thread of all of this is a hatred of authority. Anarchists hate authority of any kind. Those who hate the founders for having owned slaves are enabling anarcho-haters to overthrow the Constitution, which is a kind of birthright for all Americans, haters, and lovers alike. Love the sinner, hate the sin. Making one's actions match one's better, higher conscience is a struggle that will never end, but it is a struggle that can't be won by denial of the good and evil that cuts through the heart of every human person. It can't be won by hating persons who take on the honest struggle and fail in large ways or small. Ours is a country founded on the principle of freedom of conscience, a higher and better conscience. All men are hypocrites in large ways or small. Not all men are haters of self and neighbor. It is easy to love those who agree with us. It is difficult to love those that don't. Hatred of sin and self and neighbor is the only way to inherit the blessings of liberty. Honesty is the best policy. Though that was a rather long letter, but I thought he had some interesting things to say. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I was doing a series about the Bible, which we mostly wrapped up. I talked about the history of the Bible and some fulfilled prophecies of the Bible, a little bit about how the Bible came together. But one of the things that people object to about the Bible is that they say the Bible supposedly contradicts itself. There are a lot of alleged contradictions, and I'm going to start and probably just going to have a minute or two today, but I will continue with this next week. And I call this Principles for Dealing with Alleged Contradictions. And the first principle is this. First of all, when we're reading the Bible, we're not looking at one book. We're looking at a collection of many ancient manuscripts bound together. And missing or unclear information from manuscripts doesn't mean that what we know isn't true. See, sometimes people object to the fact that, well, in one manuscript there's a word missing or a sentence missing. Yeah, but we have thousands of these manuscripts, my friends. And what isn't missing from one or what is missing from one is not missing from another. It's like piecing dinosaur bones back together. People also report things differently. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John agreed 100% about everything, I guarantee you what people would say. They'd say, that's not four different eyewitness accounts. That's one eyewitness account, but they actually wrote four different names on them. Well, it's at least three different eyewitness accounts. With Luke, it was many because Luke was a historian who interviewed many people. But we'll talk more about this, more principles for dealing with alleged contradictions. Gives you something to look forward to, doesn't it? Always leave them wanting more, and you will get more next week on The Bob Siegel Show. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.